Live from Cape Town, this is the Voice of the Cape, 91.3 FM.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to Constitutional Matters with myself, Dakira Desai, for the fourth episode of our new exciting show marking the 20th anniversary of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. As a seven-part series, Constitution Matters brings to light a joint venture on progressive constitutionalism by the Voice of the Cape Radio, the national body of the Students for Law and Social Justice, and the Council for the Advancement of the South African Constitution. In our previous episodes, we discussed the history of the Constitution, transformative constitutionalism, and the right to education. And in this episode of Constitution Matters, we discuss the limitation of rights. A reminder to our listeners, they can WhatsApp us on 072-238-0712 or SMS us on 47913. Now in studio with me, we have Dr. Kathleen Powell, Dr. Tom Angier, and Sheikh Ihsan Talib. To begin the discussion, we focus on Section 36, the limitation of rights and how it affects Section 15, the freedom of religion, and Section 30, the freedom of culture. Now, Professor Powell, we know that the Constitution grants each citizen access to their rights, but what is meant by the limitation of rights?
To answer that, I'm going to need to quickly sketch how any right is litigated. The limitations clause of Section 36, it's part of the normal litigation process for any right. There are three main stages to litigating a right. The first is to establish the various procedural factors which ask the questions, is the person who's bringing the application actually entitled to bring it? And is the person against whom it is brought actually the bearer of the duty? So, for example, a good example is it's difficult to bring a right to housing against a private individual. That would be one of the cases where the right is simply not applicable, or usually not applicable. That's the procedural stage. The second stage is substantive. And in that, South Africa is a little bit different from, say, the USA. The question isn't just how big is the right, what does it look like, and then working out whether the conduct or the law complained of violates the right or not. What we do is you work out the scope of the right, so kind of how big it is. Then you work out whether the law or the conduct complained of falls within that scope and therefore limits the right. At that point, you simply say the right is limited. It's not infringed yet. It's not violated. Because there's a second step. Once you've determined, yes, it's been limited, you work out whether that limitation is, and the term is, reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society based on human dignity, equality, and freedom. And then they give you a number of factors that you need to consider when you try weigh up whether this limitation is okay. What you're doing at that stage is you are comparing the right of that one person against the interests of broader society, in effect. It's called a proportionality analysis. Our courts tend to just do a general weighing exercise. And that is why I think people think, when they think about the limitation of freedom of religion, they will think of Section 36. However, when we're talking about freedom of religion as limited by other rights, other constitutional rights, we're not talking about Section 36. Because Section 36 is about whether laws or lesser laws or conduct can limit a right. They're not about how big that right actually is. And when you have one right seemingly conflicting with another right, you're actually at the stage before the limitations clause where you're trying to work out how far the right extends, because it's interfacing and conflicting with another right, and you've got to work out the size or the scope of the two rights. And then just to be thorough, the final stage, if you've decided that the right has been limited and then you decide that that limitation is not justifiable, that will mean the right has been violated. And then there's a third final stage, which is working out what remedy you grant. So that's the whole story for any right. When you're looking at the right to freedom of religion, whether you're going to work with Section 36 or not depends on what the other conflicting factors are. If they are rights, then we're going to have to do a more philosophical grounded analysis of how far we understand freedom of religion to extend, how far we understand culture, equality and the other rights to extend.
Now, before we grapple with the with tangible issues, Dr. Angier, some argue that the constitution, which is based on liberal norms, is not consistent with a multicultural state. What is your view on this?
Right, so yes, I'm not an expert on the law, but I also have a philosophical background, so I'll do my best to grapple the general issue. I think that the South African constitution clearly comes from a particular legal tradition, and so far as I know, it's been influenced by, say, the Canadian constitutional settlement. So we're dealing with a set of norms which embrace countries way beyond South Africa. And it very, very well might be the case, therefore, that there will be conflicts or at least tensions between those international norms and local norms. Now, I take it that that's probably an ineliminable set of tensions, and what our task will be is to work through them and try to come to some reasonable accommodation so far as is possible. Yeah. So I think particular examples will help, but we can come on to those. Mm.
Sheikh Hassan, if you could come in here. We know that there is widespread Islamophobia around the globe, with many critics arguing that Islam contradicts so-called liberal norms. And many also have argued that and use this argument to support the view that Muslims in many communities should not be allowed to live in multicultural communities because our Sharia so-called, or they argue that our Sharia contradicts the liberal norms. You being an expert on Sharia or Islamic law, do you agree with this, or can you or do you agree that Muslims or the Sharia can operate alongside the laws of a non-Muslim state?
Yeah, thank you very much, Dakira. Firstly, this is a wonderful conversation taking place. It's the first time I'm encountering it, and it's the fourth episode, so I will be tuned in next time around. Our learned colleagues here are very honored to be here with them as well. Look, from an Islamic law perspective, obviously the sets of laws and I think the backgrounds and the history of these two systems of law is obviously different. Clearly from a developmental perspective, I think there is probably the need for us to also view history, and particularly more recent history, in terms of how sort of liberal law, so to speak, and liberal constitutionalism has developed vis-a-vis the development of Islamic law more in a kind of sort of Muslim majority kind of context. Having said that, I think it is important for us also to note that I guess like any other system of law, Islamic law is very much a system of law which is hypersensitive to context. It is a system of law which allows inherently for a measure of adaptability, as well as a certain measure of immutability or sort of fixed sort of notions of value, so to speak, etc., etc. And it is obviously a very clearly value-based system of law. So those are the kind of areas where there will be a large measure of let's say, unchangeability when it comes to values, etc. But when it comes to procedures, when it comes to you know, the ability for society to be able to develop law in accordance with the development of society, there is really a wide measure of flexibility in that regard. And so we find, for example, like in a South African context where we have this beautiful constitution, we do find that as Muslims we are very, very comfortable living in this kind of context, of course, where the rights of human beings are, and especially in a South African context where some of the fundamental values that are foregrounded and highlighted are the values such as human dignity, as opposed to some other places where they place a higher sort of value on, let's say, the freedom of expression per se, etc. And that is also because of our peculiar history. And so those obviously are kinds of values which are universal, and these are the kind of values which really I think all faith systems are very amenable, and in fact they promote. And so given certain, again, specific circumstances, the application of those rights and the implementation, as Dr. Thoma had maybe also alluded to, there may be tensions in terms of the actual implementations thereof. But in a general way, we would say that the values of the kind of value based, shall I say, system of law in terms of its implementation and application is one which is really of a universal kind and a universal type. It may find certain tensions within, for example, a context like in South Africa that have special references or specific, I think, reference to certain values and certain ethical kind of norms and standards.
Dr. Kathleen, would you like to weigh in here?
I'm interested in, when we discuss this apparent conflict between liberalism and Sharia law, it's nice to have an expert in Sharia law to speak about the values there, and I'd like to ask in more detail about them, because I'm also wondering what we're assuming the values of liberalism are. It's a white church, that term, and it's in South Africa for a lot of our history it's been a dirty word. In other areas it's considered a very positive thing. So perhaps if we could be clear what we mean by liberalism, it'll be easier to work out whether our constitution, firstly whether it is a liberal constitution, and secondly whether it accommodates religious minorities and other smaller groups.
Mm. That would actually bring me to my next question, and I think I'll pose it to you, Dr. Kathleen. How does a state reconcile imposing liberal norms, or the so-called liberal norms, on a culture whose normative values contradict these norms?
Well, if we're specifically discussing Islam, I'm not sure they do contradict, and I think that was the point that you made previously. But okay, let me make some guesses as to what liberal norms mean. I think we are talking about the autonomy of the individual and the dignity of the individual. That does not necessarily at the cost of any group, because our constitution also protects freedom of assembly, culture and religion, which are ultimately group activities. I think the extent to which liberalism is seen as a bad thing, in my experience, is because it's seen as kind of freezing the rights that people have in the situation that we're in. So a liberal constitution is seen as, for example, protecting the right to property, which will put people who already own property at an advantage and people who don't have property at a disadvantage. That is what I've understood the objection to liberalism to be. I don't see liberalism and diversity as opposed. And I suppose the conflict that you're alluding to is the conflict between the idea of human dignity meaning equality, and a value system which assigns at least different roles to different people and maybe restricts people on the basis of their sex or on various other bases. It needn't be only sex. Mm. But is that the only conflict that we're talking about? Is it about equality ultimately?
I think so. I think that with regards to religion, everyone would like to be treated equally, and we hope that our constitution would then uphold that, because I think post-apartheid, this idea of equality is sort of resounding, and we no minority or even no group within the country wants to feel as if their religious rights are stepped upon.
Yes.
Yeah.
But then the equality works internally and externally. One of the objections that's come against not only Islam but Catholicism and any other religion, quite frankly, that distinguishes between the roles that men and women may play. Mm. One of the criticisms of those religions is that they don't have equality within the religion. You alluding to another aspect, which is that religion wants equality with other religions.
Yes, yes.
But we're looking at equality on two different tiers. Let's try to tackle that.
Yeah. I think we can tackle that after the break, just not to break the discussion. So we take a break now, and when we return, we will continue the discussion on the limitation of rights. Welcome back to Constitution Matters. I'm your host, Zakira Dessa, and in this episode, we are discussing the limitation of rights. Before the break, we had quite an interesting discussion, and I think not to waver off too much, I think it became a bit too interesting for us, and we actually continued it during the break. But to continue, there was a landmark case this morning in the Cape High Court which ruled in favor of the Neisner Muslim community for the construction of a mosque, which would effectively be the first mosque in the area. And this was after residents of 22 Rawson Street contested the Neisner municipality's decision to approve an application for the construction of a mosque near the town center. Now, in considering this case, Dr. Kathleen, how does the state justify limiting the rights of a certain group when their cultural practices are inconsistent with liberal norms?
I think we must distinguish this case from a straight discrimination against Islam case. There may well have been some prejudice involved, but what you're dealing with here is the normal process that will be carried out when a public meeting place is put into a community. There'll be an option for objections from, it could be a bowling alley, it could be anything where people come together. Mm. So in this case, we are talking about a Section 36 sort of situation,
yeah,
where the municipality decide, okay, we're not going to have this because it's too noisy and there are too many people. And these are the reasons cited in the case. Religion as such was not brought up. That was brought up by the community that wanted to build a mosque. This is our way of expressing our religion. Yeah. And that is your right under the right to freedom of religion, is the right to hold and express your beliefs. So what happened here was, I think the case was decided simply on, okay, well, is there going to be too much noise? Is it going to be too much traffic? It doesn't look like there was a very serious weighing up of the right to religion against anything else. It was simply handled as, look, these objections are not tenable on the facts. Mm. If the municipality had decided, no, we are not having any mosques in Neisner ever, then we're talking a different story.
Mm. In this case, Prof, I think the municipality in the first instance, they have kind of been approving of the move. It was the some of the residents in the area who then obviously raised a certain objections. But as you mentioned, the objections were of the kind where, the whole notion of levels of, for example, noise,
traffic,
etc., etc. And so to the extent, even in the wording of some of the persons who then commented on this afterwards, that those were things which were put on a balance of what is reasonable again. Yeah. Mm.
Dr. Angia, in reading a number of comments on social media following the judgment, I found that many residents in Neisner continue to be upset about the court's judgment.
Yes.
From a philosophical point of view,
yeah,
what does this case mean for a community like Neisner, which in the judgment, it actually stated that the Neisner Muslim community was saying that the community is still quite unintegrated. From a philosophical point of view, what did this mean if this mosque is built and if the right to religion is practiced?
Right, so, I mean, it seems to me that there are common or garden issues that would apply to any institution building being built. And so noise issue would be one, and that clearly in the mosque case will have to do with a call to prayer. Mm. They seem to have dealt with that.
Yeah.
So there'll be sort of common law garden issues like that which could apply to any community institution. Now, I mean, I think the interesting ones would be the ones that are really specific to the Muslim communities, right? This case seems to me relatively uninteresting in terms of reasonable accommodation, because it's just about whether we can have, you know, a meeting place. But there are wider issues to do with, and I think this is what, you know, non-Muslims are worried about, will be to do with what practices go on in the community. So, for instance, if there's marriage taking place which is polygamous, say. Now, that would be a case of real tension or conflict between legal norms in common law, Roman Dutch law, and Sharia law. Now, as I said, I don't know, I'm not an expert in either. So I'm raising the principal question. You know, maybe people in this community, I don't know, are have issues with polygamy, and they don't want people who are practicing polygamy in their ambit. So, I mean, it seems to me those, you know, we mustn't be sort of pussyfoot around these issues. We should we should bring them out into the open and say, are there, is there anyone who wants to be in a polygamous marriage? If so, can we accommodate that within our legal structures?
Sorry, just to come in very quickly then.
Yeah.
Look, there was certainly no reference in this particular case to that kind of detail. So you're hypothesizing in this particular manner. Is really to be considered in the fact that we have legislation in this country that actually allows polygamous marriages in the form of the
customary
marriage law, etc. So that is obviously, again, a particular practice and norm which the majority of the or in accordance with some of the norms and customs of the majority of the citizens of this country, obviously it is been confirmed and it's been established.
Right.
From the Muslim community perspective, there's yes, albeit this is not really a norm in a sense, because a lot of
it's rare,
people's
isn't it?
Practice. Correct. People's practice is informed by the society in which they live. But there are instances like that. And whilst we don't have, for example, this is a long outstanding issue as well, which is currently back in the courts of law on Muslim marriages itself becoming legislated and recognized in the country, that is an area where certainly this kind of legislation will certainly feature, albeit that it is obviously going to be somewhat regulated. It's going to be subjected to certain procedures and processes itself, which is again not antithetic to Islamic law procedures. So yes, there may not have been such procedures in the past, but that doesn't mean that there is a prescription on such kinds of procedures being introduced. So similar to what you may or may, in fact, I would actually venture to say that the kind of regulatory elements that you would find in this particular instance is what you would, for example, find in some other Muslim majority countries, like, for example, like Malaysia, Indonesia, for example, which would, I would venture to say, go a little bit further down the line in terms of establishing procedure than the piece of legislation that we've just referenced a little bit earlier.
And may I ask a question here? The Muslim majority countries that recognize and regulate polygamous marriages, I imagine the purpose of a lot of those regulations are to protect the parties, and I'd imagine particularly the women within the relationship. Am I right? I mean, well, what is all that regulation for? Because one of the problems with not being recognized in South Africa is that the legal consequences which follow do not then follow. So, for example, for a woman whose husband dies, there's certain rights to his estate and rights to maintenance, things that would follow if she were legally recognized as his wife, would not follow. So the regulation of polygamous marriages, what is the purpose of that? What are the main principles that are applied?
Well, you're absolutely right. It would speak to the notion of proprietary regime that is followed, and the consequences, obviously, from a financial and proprietary perspective that would be regulated in light thereof. Albeit that the courts have already, in fact, gone ahead and deemed a woman who was simply married in accordance with Muslim rights, but having been a second wife in a marriage, to actually be deemed to be a wife. And so therefore the ruling that followed therein after was then based on the fact that she was deemed to be a wife in that union. So the courts have already proceeded.
The courts tend to have to move ahead sometimes.
They do. They do have to.
So in our last 3 minutes, unfortunately, of our show, there was a case about a month ago where we found in its first decision on the issue of women wearing Islamic headscarves at work, the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg ruled the garments could be banned, but only as part of a general policy barring all religions and political symbols at places of employment. Dr. Kathleen, how does the South African Constitution protect against similar rulings?
By having the right to freedom of religion, which includes the right to hold and express your religious convictions. And that will include crosses and whatever the other religious symbols one wants to wear. There are situations where the particular symbol could be... I'm trying to think of situations where... But I can't come up with an example, so this is not really working. There are situations where there might be practical problems with particular garb or particular symbol, accessories, shall we say. But generally, I can't see that ever happening in South Africa, because the right to freedom of religion includes the right to express your religion.
Mm. Right. So, but I mean, you have similar provisions, say, in French law, but they also have banned the burqa because they think that there's this internal norm of equality that's been violated. So you wouldn't have any sympathy with that?
No, I wouldn't, actually.
Okay.
It is problematic. I am a feminist, and I do have issues with communities which suppress women in any way, and I do have issues with a burqa. But to have outsiders tell women that they can't wear a burqa, for me, is as much a violation of equality as having somebody within that community telling them that they must. Mm-hmm. I would be all for measures that increase the autonomy of women within that community, but not that actually impose on them a norm that may not be their choice. Mm-hmm. And the other point, of course, is that for some communities, yes, it's part of their religion, but it might simply be part of their culture. For them, it's modesty to cover their bodies in a certain way. So no, I don't support banning any item of clothing.
Right.
The issue of that you're touching on in terms of custom informing religious kind of practice is very real in a sense, because we spoke earlier on about how people's sort of manifestations of the expression or their practice of Islam will differ from context to context and from, let's say, a region to region and geographical space to the other. And so certainly, especially where a dress code is concerned, there's a lot of cultural influence that actually inform the ultimate expression.
That was, unfortunately, the wrap of a really interesting discussion. We thank our guests, Dr. Kathleen Powell, Dr. Tom Angier, and Sheikh Ihsan Talib. Tune in to VOC 91.3 FM next week at 6 p.m. for the fifth episode of Constitutional Matters. Just a reminder to our listeners that the views expressed in this show is not necessarily the views of the Voice of the Cape, its management, or its staff. You are listening to Constitutional Matters with myself, Zakira Desai. Assalamu alaikum and good evening.